Thanks very much. First off, thanks, and thanks for having me here. It's been a real pleasure. Today I'm going to try to cover a good amount of material. You can see from my title, I'm supposedly addressing all the giant planets. I'm actually going to skip Saturn today, but hopefully I'll focus mainly on Jupiter, but hopefully at the end I'll get to Uranus and Neptune as well. So if I don't, ask me about them and I'll sum it up in a slide. The main study on Jupiter that I'm going to talk about for most of today is a collaboration, and I'd like to stress that it really is an equal collaboration between this group, Johannes Vicht, who wrote the code over a number of years, Moritz Heimpel, who's at the U of A, and myself. And what I'm going to talk about today is first some of the observations for the giant planets, then the results of basically shallow layer models, then deep convection models. I'll briefly mention a model I really like from Jano. Then I'll talk about our deep convection model that we've applied to understanding Jovian winds. And then lastly, I hope I can squeeze in some new models for Uranus and Neptune, for the ice giants. Okay, so first observations. The big picture is that if you look at any of the gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, Uranus, you'll see that the winds observed on the surface in the cloud layers are basically zonal. They're going back and forth in latitude for the most part. And so you'll see a big equatorial jet. It's flanked by other jets back and forth across the surface. And I have a pretty nice movie of that that I hope will play. And this is a movie from Ashwin Basavada, and he took images from the Cassini flyby of Jupiter, and he's projected them so we're looking down onto the, I believe this is the North Pole, and we're looking down towards the equator. And right about here, we're getting down to, I forget what's the minimum latitude here, but it's, But that's basically the edge of the equatorial jet. And then you can see some retrograde flow, prograde flow, retrograde. And then up here at high latitude, I think you can see there are some really fine-scale jets and a lot more small-scale vortices up here near the pole. So there's really rich behavior in the zonal motions on Jupiter. And if we take all the data and take an average over the time of the Cassini imaging, you get a zonal flow pattern similar to this. And here we're measuring the zonal winds relative to the deep-seated magnetic field reference frame. And you can see there's a really powerful equatorial jet. Velocities are reaching up to about 150 meters per second. It's got this big dimple. It's flanked on either side by a retrograde jet. Then there's this northern jet at about 24 degrees latitude, also very large. And then at high latitudes, you have smaller length scale, smaller amplitude jets. I'd also like to point out what I've really never heard mentioned, and I think it's because the Cassini data didn't exist yet, was that above about 70 degrees, you really get fine scale structures. And those jets were long-lived over the lifetime of the flyby. So the flyby got about 30 days of data, roughly. And those small-scale structures are not noise. They're real, and they were there for 30 days. And so you really never hear people talk about maybe what I'll call the ultra-fine-scale jets at high latitudes. But I think they're interesting, and therefore I think resolving the high latitudes is really relevant. Now, the one other thing I should mention, on this figure, you can see on the x-axis, you have wind speed on the surface measured in meters per second. Pretty fast, getting up to about 150 meters per second. But if you normalize that or non-dimensionalize that by the rotation rate of the planet, then you can talk about it in terms of this non-dimensional parameter, the Rossby number. And you can see The values of the velocity in terms of raw speed number are much less than 1. So the velocities are still much smaller than effectively the rotation velocity of the planet. Dynamically, what that means is that Coriolis forces are going to be very important. They're probably going to dominate over inertial terms in the flow. Okay? So here's my unbearably schematic of giant planets. It's really simple, and I'm going to kind of leave it that way. But what you have is you have a very thin outermost stratosphere, effectively, in which you have clouds that we can observe. Just below that is a deep atmosphere. So this is, when I say deep atmosphere, I'm saying it's molecular fluid. It's not metallized. It's not a conductor. And it reaches some depth inside the material. And then shown here, I show a sharp discontinuity to a metallized hydrogen core. It doesn't appear that that's really correct, but that's how I'm going to simplify it for now. And this is a pretty good schematic of one of our models. So we're just going to worry in our simulations today about the convection in the deep atmosphere. I'll compare that to shallow water or shallow layer models, which just worry about the flow in the cloud layer itself. Okay? Okay. So, one other observable for the giant planets is the thermal emission. So for both Jupiter and Saturn, the absorbed insulation looks about like this. Peaked at the equator, minimum at the poles. But when we look at the emitted energy, one, it's when you integrate, it's about twice the amount that's absorbed, and it's basically flat as a function of latitude. So dynamically, something's going on. We're obviously transferring heat in latitude. That's the case for Jupiter. Here's the case for Saturn. And so let's just also look at Uranus and Neptune. Uranus is slightly anomalous. We don't have very good data for this, but it appears that there's not much coming from the interior of the planet, as there must be for Jupiter and Saturn. Here for Neptune, there's a hell of a lot more coming out than we're putting in, so there's got to be heat escaping from the interior. So then the point is, the zonal winds might be driven by insulation. We definitely have an energy source that's external, but there's also energy coming from the interior. And so one of the big questions is, which of these sources dominates? What's driving these zonal winds on these planets? And so people have developed two different types of models, shallow layer and deep convection. What I'll show in the next section of this talk is that both models can generate some aspects of the observed zonal winds. And we're going to play with these different models to try to come up with basically a best model to explain the observations. First, I'm going to talk about shallow layer models. Again, this is a very rich field of its own. I'm going to simplify it massively in the next couple of slides. But basically, in shallow layer models, you're simulating turbulent flow on a rotating spherical surface of some radius R naught. Since it's effectively 2D, the surface, there's no strong Z dependence, so you can't really have convection in these actual simulations, but you can do a very good job simulating the dynamics of the outer weather layer. Okay? In these figures, local vorticity is curl cross U, right there, psi. And then planetary vorticity in one of these on the surface of this shell is basically perpendicular to the local surface. Again, you can't have any strong Z motion, so we're just worried about motions in the local XY plane. And the fluid layer depth can actually vary, and we'll call that H. So now let's worry about turbulence in these models. And actually, let's just worry about turbulence in general. For 3D turbulence, there's typically a cascade of energy from effectively the injection scale of the energy down to some dissipation scale. So typically, energy travels to smaller and smaller length scale. But in perfectly 2D turbulence, the dynamics are different, and you actually get an inverse energy cascade. And instead, if it's 2D, energy will tend to increase. The eddies will tend to increase in size, basically till they're at the domain size. Okay? And that's critical for all the dynamics I'm going to talk about later. 2D turbulence tends to increase to the domain size. Okay. So now, let's talk a little bit about potential vorticity and its conservation. In an inviscid shallow fluid layer, what's called potential vorticity, basically local vorticity plus planetary vorticity, divided by the layer height, is a conserved quantity. Okay? And so, if we then worry about basically motions of a column, or sorry, of a vortex on the surface, we first need to consider how the background vorticity varies with latitude. And so Taylor expanding about some latitude, we'll call it theta. You can see it's 2 omega sine theta right at this latitude, and then making a local Taylor expansion, we can then take the gradient times some local Cartesian y, and we can call that f naught plus beta y. So beta is the gradient, about this location. And if we look, it's 2 omega cos theta over r naught. So basically, if we now go in positive y, then the value of f is increasing towards the pole. You can see it's getting to be a smaller and smaller increase. This actually goes to zero at the pole itself. But it is increasing this direction, decreasing towards the equator. Okay. Now, let's just worry again about a local vortex. So if we're a local vortex and we're living on this beta plane, so to speak, we've made this local approximation, done this local Taylor expansion, then what's conserved is local vorticity plus F naught at that location plus the background, the gradient, beta times y. H is a constant. That's what I'm assuming here. F naught is a constant at this location. And so we've got to conserve local vorticity plus this advection term, right? This change with position. So now let's just do a simple scaling. And for vorticity, we have some velocity divided by a length scale, curl cross u. So that's u over l. And we'll use that same l for our typical length scale, beta times l. So that's got to be constant. So for really, really small length scales, the first term dominates. For really small l, u over l is large, beta times l is small. So for very small length scales, we can forget about this term. What's that mean? That means for very small length scales, the turbulence, the eddies feel as if they're two-dimensional. They don't really feel the background gradient for a very small length scale. Now, as we increase the length scale, at some point, this term becomes comparable to this term. So, as we increase the length scale, we expect the length scale to increase, I forgot to say, because if we're at a very small scale, then this term doesn't matter, and it's 2D turbulence. So the eddies are going to, via various processes, increase in size until we hit the scale where this is comparable to this. When we're at that scale, then basically this eddy is feeling the curvature of the shell. Does that make sense? And so this length scale, if we solve for L, is square root of U over beta. Okay? That gives us a really important scale that's called the Rhine scale. and it was first come up with by Peter Rhines, and it's effectively the length scale where curvature effects stop the inverse cascade of energy on a spherical shell. Does that make sense? Okay. So it's at this length scale you expect turbulent eddies to cease growing. Instead, you start pumping energy basically into what are called Rossby waves, and eventually that energy gets transferred into zonal motions. So we expect in these shallow layer models to get zonal jets at the scale of the Rossby length scale. Okay? And here's a paper by Cho and Palvani from 1996 in which they've carried out actually a shallow water simulation. And so they have an initial field of turbulent eddies. They let them evolve in time. And eventually what you get out of them, they get some coherent vortices, and they also get a bunch of bands. So they get banded flow, basically jets, with a typical length scale of the Rhine scale. So that appears to work. And so again, here's a figure from their paper showing the zonal flow in their model. So latitude versus velocity. And again, they get some large-scale jets. They get strong equatorial jets, similar to those you see on, for instance, Jupiter and Saturn. But they're always retrograde. And we were talking about this earlier. It appears they effectively always have to be retrograde in these models, theoretically. That's a problem because the observed jets are strongly prograde. So these are able to explain effectively the length scale of the smaller scale jets. They get large scale equatorial jets, but they're always pointed effectively in the wrong direction. So they can explain some of, but not all of the observations. Okay? Okay, so now let's compare that to the deep convection models. This idea was first proposed by Fritz Busa in 1976. Here we have a deep spherical shell of fluid, so it's not a 2D outer layer. Instead, we're worried about flow through the entire deep atmosphere. And it's assumed that for rapidly rotating fluid mechanics, the motions tend to line up with the rotation axis. And so we expect to have these long columns. And according to his theory, we can get multiple jets by having very well organized nested cylinders of these columns. And it's a nice idea, and it got this whole deep convection game going. I think I'll show you, it doesn't appear to work, but the basic idea does have a lot of teeth. So again, here's a rotating spherical shell of fluid shown over here. I've put some inner boundary on the fluid region. And what you see is basically that the flow gets broken up into two different regions. This inner boundary, shown in red, acts to actually segregate the flow. And I kind of mentioned before that the flow tries to stay aligned with the rotation axis. So if it were to, let's say, go across this cylinder tangent to the equator, to the inner boundary, that column would have to break in half, which would mean there'd be a massive, basically, shear in Z, right? It'd be a massive change in the flow field in Z. And the flow wants to stay columnar. It doesn't want to have any big shears in Z. That's the effect of rotation. So the net effect, therefore, is that you break up the flow into two regions. One, the region outside the tangent cylinder, and then the high latitude region inside the tangent cylinder. Okay? So the spherical shell geometry is critical. Now, let's worry about potential vorticity conservation in a deep shell of fluid. Here I don't even show an inner core. It's just a full sphere of fluid. at any position, there's the same background vorticity. Planetary vorticity is the same. The whole thing feels the rotation of the whole planet. It's no longer a thin shell. So you can just say there's F naught everywhere and it's a constant, be 2 omega. There's the local vorticity, but now the height of the fluid layer changes with position. Okay? And so now if you work it out, there's effectively a topographic beta effect. So instead of changing the orientation of a vortex, you're instead squashing it or stretching it. Okay? That's the difference. And that ends up producing a different sign to the potential vorticity gradient. Here, as you go further from the axis, you're squishing more, and effectively, therefore, there's a positive gradient towards the equator. So that's opposite to the previous case, the shallow layer case. And so what's the effect of this? Well, let's first just imagine we're in a layer of fluid with not a spherical shell above it, but let's just say planar bottom boundary, sloping top boundary, constant slope. So constant topographic beta effect. So now, if I imagine I'm moving fluid in a little around a column, I've got some column of fluid in there and it's a little vortex and it's going around. As it moves further from the axis, this is going to get squashed. The column's going to get squashed down by the topography. I'm imagining it's going to smaller topography as I move away. And so the resulting induced vorticity has got to be negative. Okay, I'm going to actually larger PV gradient. So the induced vortex vorticity is negative. When I move inwards, it's the opposite effect. The induced vorticity is positive. So if I look at the effect of this induced vorticity on the original vortex, it'll act to push it this way, and this one will act to push it that way. Right? So then there's a net motion of this. It's going to tend to drift in the prograde direction. So PV conservation in this case means columns of fluid, vortices will tend to drift off in the prograde direction. However, on a full sphere, the topography isn't constant. It's actually getting steeper as you go to the equator. So topographic beta is getting larger as you go to further distance from the rotation axis. So therefore, you need a bigger vortex out here, a bigger induced vorticity here than here. What's that do? That effectively shears your original vortex. There's a bigger response the further you go away from the rotation axis, so you tend to shear the vortex into the prograde direction. So now it's drifting, but it's also getting sheared. And that shear has an important effect. So now if you look at the onset of convection in a sphere, this is also from Busa. This is Busa, I think, 1970. Then what you'll see is at the onset of convection, if I heat the fluid in here in a rapidly rotating shell and let fluid motions first start, they'll start via columns that are tilted in the prograde direction. You can see this guy's tilted a little bit in that direction. So, now looking down from the North Pole, we have all these tilted vortices. And what that does is, that leads to basically a nonlinear angular momentum flux, what are called Reynolds stresses. So, the fluid traveling outwards is typically also traveling, which direction is that? To the east. Fluid traveling inwards is going in the direction opposite rotation. So you're piling up basically a little bit of momentum at the outer boundary with all these motions. So eventually you're causing basically an angular momentum flux near your outer boundary that's going to produce an eastward jet here and a westward jet there. Okay. So here's a simulation. I might show this twice. Here's a simulation. We're looking down from the North Pole. Oops, I didn't know that would happen. And let's not worry about that for a minute yet. Let's first just worry about this one. We're looking down from the North Pole, We're heating here and cooling here. And so the columns that form inside this spherical shell are going to get tilted in the prograde direction. And I think you can see that all these are tilted in the prograde direction. And that then drives a zonal flow. And what's kind of nice about this is that you have an outbreak of plumes here, which then drives an increase in the wind, which then rips apart the plumes. And then it starts over again. Viewed from the outer boundary, you could see near the equator, big prograde flow. At higher latitude, near this tangent cylinder, retrograde flow. That's all due to these Reynolds stresses on convection columns forming, in this case, just outside the tangent cylinder. So I've got an inner core in this case. Does that make sense? Hopefully, yes. Okay. Any questions on it? Yeah.
If that was talking about the surface temperature flux, if we were just to look at a picture of, just I look like the edge of the jets were quite wavy. If we were just to look at a picture of, say, effective traces on the surface, would it look a lot sharper?
You know, I haven't done it, so I don't know. But the velocity field looks pretty similar to the surface heat flux.
Okay.
It's all getting carried around. Yeah. The zonal flow is dominating. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So, let's compare the two models. Shallow layer model. You impose turbulence on a spherical shell. You get a retrograde equatorial jet, which doesn't really work. But you get higher latitude Rhine scale jets, which do appear to work. In contrast, in deep convection models, basically almost all the prior deep convection models, including the ones I just showed, were what I would call quasi-laminar. They aren't really fully turbulent. And what you get, though, is you always get a prograde equatorial jet flanked by two retrograde jets, all in this region outside the tangent cylinder. And then at higher latitudes, you typically don't get much at all. You could see, I hope, in this picture, there's not really anything going on up here. There's basically almost no convection there. And since there's no convection, it sure isn't going to generate any jets. So there's basically nothing happening at high latitudes. One big equatorial jet that's prograde, surrounded by two retrograde flanking jets. So this does a good job in the equatorial region, but not so good at high latitudes. This, not so good in the equatorial region, pretty good at high latitudes. So, okay. So now let's look at Jano's recent shallow layer model. What he did was he took a 2D shallow layer model, but he kind of said, you know, I can impose any beta parameter I want. And so I'll select the function that arises for topographic beta. So one, that means opposite sign and slightly different parameterization. And when he does that, and then he just lets it go. So this is effectively a shallow layer model that's kind of acting like a deep layer model. And he does it for a full sphere. And what he gets then is a prograde equatorial jet, the dashed line are the observations for Jupiter, here for Saturn, and the solid line are the results of his model. And so you can see, for the first time, he gets, in all his models basically, a prograde equatorial jet from a 2D model. It's very nice. All he did was he used the beta parameterization that you would get for topography in a spherical shell. He claims in this that he also gets Rhine scale high latitude jets that look similar to Jupiter and Saturn. I don't really see that, but to me the more important point is that he gets, with a 2D model, the equatorial flow similar to the giant planets. Okay. Yeah. Uh, So you can see, as you go further from the axis, DHDS is actually 1 over H naught DHDS is getting larger. So it's positive and large. Actually, it's negative and large, but there's a minus sign out here. Okay? So the key point is, actually, in this case, that it's a slightly different functional form, I think, but it's also a change in sign. So when you change the sign in this 2D model, the jet changes direction. That's Yano's main result. Okay. So we've now tried to build on this. This is a recent... So now I'm going to present the recent results of the work of Heinpohl, myself, and Johannes Vicht. And what we did was we first looked into the fact that Yano points out that he gets Rhine-scale jets, and that explains almost everything. But he doesn't really seem to get the right jet wavelength at all. If you look, that doesn't really look... I would argue that these regions don't look similar at all. So, and we think that might be because he's doing a full sphere. And we're pretty sure that in Jupiter, it's a thin spherical shell. So what we did was we calculated topographic beta in the region outside the tangent cylinder and in the region inside. And you can see there's a scaling discontinuity. These are two different functional forms. So there should be a scaling discontinuity in the Rhine's length across the tangent cylinder. There should be a sharp jump. In addition, what we find is that in the region inside the tangent cylinder, topographic beta gets large just as we cross the tangent cylinder. Therefore, where this is large, the Rhine's length is small. So as we cross the tangent cylinder, going to higher latitude, we expect to see smaller scale jets. Okay? And so, did I plot that? So, assuming a constant velocity, a constant U everywhere in a given model, we expect that the Rhine scale in a spherical shell at different ratios of the outer boundary radius to the inner boundary radius will do something like this. Let's choose 0.95. We'll have this thick line is for the region outside the tangent cylinder. As we get to right here, we expect a discontinuous jump in the Rhine scale to these very small values, and then they join at high latitude again. So this discontinuity occurs basically at the tangent cylinder latitude. And so we did some test cases to see if this is roughly correct. Here is the case where chi is what's called the radius ratio, is basically the thickness of the shell. So it's the ratio of the inner boundary to the outer boundary. So for a shallow layer model, it would be 1. For an inner boundary that's half the radius of the outer boundary, it'd be 0.5, and on and on. So here's a radius ratio for a relatively thin shell, 0.75. And these dashed lines represent the tangent cylinder latitude. And what you see is, here's 0.75, here's 0.85, and here's a really thin shell of 0.9. You see that the equatorial jet basically is controlled by the size of the tangent cylinder. Just like in that previous movie, that prograde jet is always forming in the equatorial region outside the tangent cylinder. So it seems that controls, at first order, the width of the equatorial jet. And then the length scale of the higher latitude Rhine scale jets, 1 becomes smaller as you go to higher radius ratio. So the thinner the shell, the smaller scale is the Rhine scale. And in addition, the more room there is for high latitude jets to form, there's a larger region inside the tangent cylinder. So the outcrops of this cylinder is moving to lower and lower latitude as you go to a bigger and bigger inner core. So that appears to work. It means 3D shell that's relatively thin gets you a prograde equatorial jet flanked by smaller scale high latitude jets. So then we went back and basically looked in the literature for a slightly more detailed model of Jupiter's interior. And what you see is that it looks like the depth of the zonal flow is only reaching down about 10% of the way into the planet in the most recent interior models. It used to be people assumed it was reaching about 40% of the way in, or even 50% of the way in. But the most recent experiments suggest that the electrical conductivity of the atmosphere is becoming non-negligible, relatively close to the surface, about 10% of the way in. And once the electrical conductivity gets pretty high, it'll be hard to have supermassive shearing flows because they would generate huge Lorentz forces, which would then basically damp them out. So, the newest model suggests that somewhere between 0.85 and 0.95, any deep winds are going to have to truncate electromagnetically. So we use that. We then built our model to look somewhat like this. The flow is then in this thin shell. That differs strongly from Boos's older model, where the flow is in a much thicker shell. However, I want to stress, both these are still solving for 3D convective motions. Another thing that mattered, there was a recent paper by Uli Christensen in which he showed that the zonal flows eventually reach some asymptotic scaling. And so we took his asymptotic scaling laws and used them to choose how strong we force the flow. So this is effectively Rossby number, the velocity, as a function of the forcing, the thermal forcing. And so we chose our thermal forcing to get a value roughly similar to Jupiter. In our model, we solve Navier-Stokes equation, energy equation, and we assume, make a huge assumption, that the fluid is Boussinesque, that it's basically incompressible except for thermal terms. Now, I mean, I would argue this is the biggest simplification of many in our model, because even though I've said we're only going to solve in a thin shell, only 0.9, you know, only the outermost 10% of Jupiter, Jupiter has a radius of 70,000 kilometers. So a thin shell is still 7,000 kilometers thick. Okay, maybe the gas compresses, right? So we're making a huge assumption, but that's where we're starting off from. Okay? We're using Johannes's magic spectral transform code, spherical harmonics in Latin long. This gives us troubles near the poles, Chebyshev in radius, and basically Courant time stepping on the grid. Input parameters, they're pretty outrageous. They're about Rayleigh number, if this means if it is about 10 to the 10, which means we're strongly forcing the flow. The Ekman number basically is the inverse rotation rate, and we chose a value of 3 times 10 to the minus 6. That's the lowest value we could afford to integrate. It means that the viscous forces are about a million times weaker than the Coriolis term. Okay? Prandtl number, this has to do with the material properties. It's about, basically, it's what they estimate in the latest interior models. And the radius ratio, the thinnest we could afford was about 0.9, so that's what we did. What we get out of it is basically turbulent convection. The Reynolds number from these models, on average, it gets to up to about 5 × 10⁴, which is incredibly high for a numerical model. So I would argue the flow is turbulent. However, the Rossby number is still small. So the flow is turbulent, and yet that turbulence is still dominated by rotational effects. Okay? That's key here. We've got turbulence, but it's dominated by rotation. Lastly, the grid is pretty big, and it took a long time to run. To help us, we used hyperdiffusion, and we only solved on 1/8 of a sphere. Okay? We checked. It basically doesn't have a huge effect if we go to a quarter of a sphere, and then we just went back to 1/8 because these are expensive. Okay, so what do we get? So in this model, what you see here, here's the azimuthal flow on the outer boundary. Conditions are stress-free on the outer and inner boundary. Red means prograde. Blue means retrograde. And so you get a really large equatorial jet flanked by two retrograde jets and then a couple of higher latitude alternating jets. This meridional slice shows that the structures are very well aligned with the rotation axis, as you'd expect in a rapidly rotating flow. And here's the basically temperature throughout the boundary. So let's compare our results to the observations for Jupiter. Here's Jupiter on the left. Here are the results of our model at a couple different time steps, shown here on the right. First, I'd like to point out, this was my most recent model prior to this run. And I just want to stress how badly the quasi-lameter cases really compare to Jupiter. Okay, so here's Rossby number versus latitude. Yeah, I get a big equatorial prograde jet, sort of like this, and it's flanked by two big retrograde jets, sort of like this, but it really doesn't get anything at high latitude. It's just this big, you get those big retrograde jets and then they diffuse off to the poles. So I'd argue that stinks, right? Or it sure stinks compared to this. Now we've gone to the case where we have turbulence in a realistic geometry that's still controlled by rotation. And so these different time steps show basically the model as it spins up. And what you see is that the high latitude jets and most of the equatorial jet equilibrates relatively quickly. Right near the equator, you actually start off with this dimple that then over time has a slow transient and leaves the system. When it's fully spun up in another, I forget how long, but a bit more, this is actually gone altogether. So that's interesting. Maybe the equatorial dimple is a transient. Doesn't have to be, though. Could be from solar insulation effects. But it's interesting that it's even there at any time. And you can notice, one, that our equatorial jet is a little broader than what's on Jupiter. You can see we've plotted the tangent cylinder latitude in our model on both. And really, this is a bit narrower than this. Two, the scale to our high latitude jets is a bit too large. So to solve both of these, we did a fit, and it suggests we would get a better model if we could go to a case with a radius ratio of 0.95. So just a factor of 2 in shell thickness, but a factor of 2 in shell thickness actually would cost us a lot because the structures would get, let's say, roughly a factor of 2 smaller. It would be horrible. And basically, we couldn't afford to run it. So we're going to stick with this, and I'm going to argue that this still gets the main large-scale features in the flow. Does it get a great red spot? No. I'm going to argue that that's a shallow layer feature that we can't resolve. Also, does it get this structure at high latitude at 24 degrees north? No, it doesn't show up at all. And I just read a paper arguing that that's a deep structure. And yet, we don't have any good way to get it into our model. It might be nice to put it in as a perturbation and see what happens to it. but it definitely doesn't arise in any case we can come up with. One thing we often get asked is, how is this model tuned? How'd you tune it to look like Jupiter or to have a similar profile? And so what have we got in this model? One, we've got a relatively high radius ratio, the lowest Ekman number we can afford, so the fastest rotation rate. And we've chosen the thermal forcing so that our peak velocity, basically, of the equatorial jet is similar to that of Jupiter's. We haven't chosen anything else. So these are all simply developing naturally out of the turbulence. And if we compare basically the Rhine scales as a function of latitude, here's the Rhine scale. Here's our estimate of the Rhine scale on Jupiter versus in our model. Neither of them work too badly, but it appears they're roughly constant at high latitudes in both cases. I would actually expect there to be an increase with latitude. So actually, it's close to the Rhine scale in our model, but it's not exactly perfect. And actually, I think that's relevant. So in our model, we get what's called quasi-geostrophic, rapidly rotating convective turbulence in a relatively thin spherical shell. That generates at the same time a prograde equatorial jet and alternating high latitude jets. It appears that the scaling is roughly following Rhine scaling. In other words, there's a strong discontinuity across the tangent cylinder, which is what we expect. And there are smaller scale jets at high latitudes. Okay. Where do we go from there? Well, I said we need this regional Rhine scale fit. I don't really like that. It's not really, we shouldn't have to do that. So it would be nice to carry out a parameter search to see what's really going on with that. But we simply can't afford to. This run itself took a number of months. And I think the way to go is to try to come up with 2D models similar to Jano's, but with a thin shell beta parameterization. And that should allow us to much more efficiently study to see if we can really follow the Rhine scaling, if that's really correct. What else? Well, I mentioned, I hope you can see here, there are all these small scale vortices at high latitude, and I don't really think we're getting any of those in the present code. And I think you can see that somehow those are leading to these small-scale, ultra-fine-scale jets. I've done an experiment, a laboratory experiment, previously to study flow in the Earth's core and see if it works. So I left the light on, unfortunately, so you see that rotating around. The camera's on the rotating table, and you can see you get all these fine-scale vortices forming near the poles. So they're now propagating off a heater, and they've hit the top boundary of our spherical shell, and then they start drifting around. And over time, you get these fine-scale structures and little back-and-forth motions if you actually average it out. And I wonder if that's similar to what we see near the poles. But in all truth, this really isn't good enough. I'm still far, far away from Jovian parameters. Those are huge relative to the scale of the shell. On Jupiter, they're really tiny, which is what's leading to the tiny jets. So I'd like to look into that. And the other question is, why does the flow stop and how does it stop with depth? How does this electromagnetic braking work? I don't know. I would argue nobody really knows. So it'd be nice to model that. And lastly, compressibility is absolutely relevant here. As I said, it's a 7,000 kilometer thick layer at least. So it'd be nice to add in and see how compressibility changes the behavior. So that's Jupiter. Now, I'm out of time. I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thickness of the convecting zone itself changes from the equator to the pole. If the connection gets thinner to the pole, then you will get both ingredients that you want.
Well, that's sort of what we have in our model. Outside of the tangent cylinder, effectively, columns are much deeper. They span the entire shell. Inside the tangent cylinder, they're just either in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. So effectively...
What if the thickness of it is smaller? Because if the thickness is smaller, then you will get more 2D structure at the pole.
That might be relevant, but I would argue we don't need it. See what I mean? I would argue at first order, we're already getting that. So I don't think we need to add that in. Maybe if we included, I mean, the planet isn't actually spherical. You know, it's a little bit oblate. So maybe that's occurring a bit. But I don't think it's first order what I would worry about. I feel like I'm already getting that behavior at some level. Yeah? So what breaks the symmetry actually is what I'm calling the inner boundary. So here's badly drawn. Here's whatever this truncation depth with depth. It's probably due to conductivity and or increase in density. But the zonal flow doesn't go deeper than this, right? So now if I worry about the fact that rotation is going to segregate the flow to a region outside the tangent cylinder versus inside the tangent cylinder, then I expect different behavior here versus here. In other words, the flows are going to be dynamically similar, but the flow up here doesn't have any idea what the flow down here is doing. So there's no reason for there to be perfect symmetry across the equator. And we don't get perfect symmetry across the equator, nor does Jupiter have perfect symmetry across the equator. So that, again, to me, makes sense. Is that good? Anybody else? Yeah.
I was just wondering why your plumes had a roughly 6-point symmetry.
Oh, sorry. Great question. So we haven't actually solved on a full sphere. Again, unfortunately, these runs killed us in terms of computational time. So instead of doing a full sphere, we did 1/8 of a sphere and put periodic conditions on. Nah, they're 8-fold. If you can get them to be 6-fold, that would be awesome.
So, within this tangent cylinder, you're still using a stress-free boundary condition in the inner core. Is there a reasonable assumption? What do you think changed?
This is why I ask, how does the coupling work? This is why I said following work needs to be, one of the questions we need to address is, how do you truncate the zonal flow with depth? What truncates it? How does it truncate? You have a similar question at almost any of these different layers. If you want to talk about stratosphere versus deep atmosphere, how are they coupled again? This is one of the big limitations. And this is one of the hard parts. We were talking earlier about how could you do that and what's a possible way. It's the same issue here. What's the coupling? So, you know, I've actually carried out... maybe I have a slide here. I carried out some simulations where I did use a, here it is. Okay. So, I don't know if this will work. Yeah. So here are two cases where in the solid line, the inner boundary and the outer boundary are both stress-free. And what you can see is you have to conserve angular momentum in that case. So you get a prograde jet here. Well, it has to be flanked by retrograde jets. It has to be. While if you make the inner boundary rigid, well, you don't really have to conserve angular momentum in that case because you have friction. And in that case, basically what happens is it then torques the whole jet forward so that it's kind of attached to this launching point, the inner boundary. And so you push the whole jet forward a little bit and anchor it on the inner boundary. And You know, this may, I think, this ties in to the question of why are the Jets net prograde? If you add everything up on the surface, they're slightly prograde. It may have something to do with what's the coupling. What's the coupling at depth? Is it effectively stress-free or not? I don't think it is. It's too simple. But for now, that's what we use. And Moritz, my co-author, is now doing more complex cases with rigid inner boundaries. And he's looking at torques between the mantle and, or sorry, the outer atmosphere and the effectively rigid core, he's assuming. So you can worry about that. But for these models, we just chose the simplest things we could. So we just went stress-free on both. Okay, I'll do.
I have a simple question. How can we explain that the strongest jets are observed on Neptune?
Okay, so super. I can do it. I can do that in one slide. Maybe I can't. How do I find those slides? So the idea is this. Everything I've talked about so far has been in the low Rossby number regime, where you have these columnar flows. They generate a prograde equatorial jet, which is actually kind of strange. If you go to the case where the rotation's weak, then in order to conserve angular momentum, even in a deep shell of fluid, the fluid moving out to greater cylindrical latitude has to be going slower. So these are the shallow layer models, which naturally have that. I carried out a deep convection case in really a deep atmospheric zone and went to the case where the buoyancy force is almost twice the rotational force. So you're no longer absolutely constrained to be 2D and axial and columnar. And you get a flow field like this. So you get a big retrograde jet flanked by high latitude jets. And I think here's our solution, and here are the observations. This is what you get for Neptune. This is what you get for Uranus. It looks a lot like this. I think it almost, here are the shallow layer models. I think Cho and Polvani's models do a pretty good job, but I would argue ours do equally as good a job of explaining those flows. So I think the difference might be this fundamental balance between low Rossby number and high Rossby number. That's my estimation.
Would that be soft